Report from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium in Urbana. On Monday, January 23rd at 7 p.m., the Corkscrew will be hosting a Robert Burns Night celebration and dinner at Beccaro in downtown Champaign. The multi-course dinner will include traditional Scottish fare, a bagpipe player, and the trimmings associated with a Burns Night event. Information at 337-7704 or on the web at thecorkscrew.com.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. This afternoon, a conversation with journalist David Barabee. He's the author of the new book, Us and Them, Understanding Your Tribal Mind. We'll talk with him about how and why we separate ourselves into groups, races, religions, clubs, and cliques. In his book, Barabee examines our need to identify and categorize one another and how we group ourselves and others in human kinds. A human kind is a group of people defined by a certain characteristic, something shared. Cub fans and White Sox fans are humankind, so too Democrats and Republicans, union members, professors, friends of public radio. Barabee says we can't live without our tribal sense, but he also takes note of its sinister side. He says the central question of our time is, why can't we all get along? Why instead do people live and die in nations, races, ethnic groups, religious traditions, and ideologies that mark some of us as part of us and others as them? Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guest, David Barabee. I look forward to hearing from you. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, so if you're listening outside the Champaign-Urbana area, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. WILL. David Barabee has written on scientific and cultural issues for many publications, including The New York Times, The New Republic, and Slate. His book, Us and Them, Understanding Your Tribal Mind, is published by Little Brown and Company. Again, the phone numbers, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. David Barabee, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. I gave a rather cursory definition of humankind in my introduction, so maybe to begin with a couple of questions here at the top. Would you elaborate on the idea of humankind and tell us something about how that term was coined?
Sure. By the way, I thought your definition was enviably good. I thought that you got the essence of it, and it's a difficult This whole subject is difficult to talk about. We don't really have a language for it. We have a language to talk about race and a language to talk about family and a language to talk about nations and so on. But we speak about all these things as if they were the same in many ways, certainly emotionally. That is to say, for example, in my book, I quote an interview between J.C. Watts, when he was leaving Congress, and an interview on CNN, whose name escapes me at the moment. I think it might have been Paul Begala. But in any event, the two of them are sitting there, and one of them is saying, you know, you're black and I'm white. You're conservative and I'm liberal. But that's not the important difference between us. The important difference between us is, and then they started talking about how they rooted for different football teams. And now, obviously, that's not the most important difference, and they knew it, but it's interesting and important that you can talk about the one kind of affiliation in the same language as you use for another. You know, you go to an office, you go out to get a job or something, and people say, oh, this is a terrific office, you'll like it here, it's just like family here, you know. And so, I mean, I'm not saying these things are equivalent, they're certainly not, in any, you know, there are a lot of important differences, but the fact that emotionally we can use the same language to talk about them suggests that there's some kind of underlying common ground in the human mind that lets us sort of see and feel these things to be similar or the same. And so humankind is a term that has been used by a few scholars to try to talk about this common ground without getting so vague that you're just kind of saying nothing or getting too specific. Because if you start, you know, if you want to talk about the history of anti-Semitism, that's a very important subject and a very well-documented subject and one that's been much thought about. But it is a particular history. And if you want to try to generalize and talk about in what sense can we say this relates to other human experiences, you need a way to say there are things that are in common about this experience and things that are separate. So what is it that's in common? And it's difficult because, of course, you know, there's a lot of different things that people will die for and people will kill for in this world. Communism, patriotism, religion, culture. I know it's a sort of fuzzy sounding term, but we need a way to talk about things that people can get so worked up about and care so much about that they matter more than life, without attaching to that thought any particular thing, you know, because we want to talk about what's common to this experience in all human minds and not a particular history of racism in this country or a particular history of religious conflict in Northern Ireland or so on. Because it's important to talk about the particulars, but the general background is also important, and that's kind of what the term is for. So I don't know if that helps.
Yeah, and when can you give us some sense of when thinkers began thinking about humankind?
There's kind of two people who use the term humankind have used it recently. One is Ian Hacking, who's a philosopher at the University of Toronto, who used it to talk about bodies of people that were created by bureaucracies. That is to say, he doesn't use it to refer to races or religions. He thinks that's a different barrel of apples. But he notes that in the 19th century, with the birth of all sorts of technologies for keeping information and gathering information, and the birth of statistics, people noticing that you could apply statistics that had been used originally to talk about stars or crops, that you could actually apply them to people and get bell curves and so on, you suddenly had an explosion of new categories for people, categorizations for mental capacity and for economic class and for geographical location and for family size and religious affiliation and vast outburst of record keeping. And so he's interested in humankinds like that, humankinds where you don't know you're a member of it, and then you read in the paper that there's a kind of person called type A, and you think, oh, gee, that's me. Mm. And then you start to use that to understand yourself, and you discuss it with other people, and not only are you using the term and it's coming to sort of be believed in, but by discussing it, you are, in fact, kind of changing it. A really good example of that is Red America and Blue America. I mean, the first time I saw red states and blue states, they were, I think Reagan was running for re-election, and they were used to tell you who won the state. That was it. That's all it meant. Now we talk about red state food and blue state culture and blue state attitudes, and I mean, it's become a way we understand ourselves, and Hacking calls that a looping effect. So that's one use of the term humankind. And then the other person who uses a lot is a guy named Larry Hirschfeld, who was at the University of Michigan for a long time in psychological anthropology, and now he's here at the New School in New York. And his definition of a humankind is simply any kind of category where people look around and say, oh, they're like me, those people over there. And that's closer to the term as I'm using it. Because he would include pretty much anything that has some of that sort of psychological heft. I guess I'm even looser with it, because I think that when you get on the 815 Staten Island ferry and you start to feel like, okay, we're the ferry gang, mm-hmm. we're the 815 gang. Even then, I think you're starting to get some of these effects of, well, okay, I care more about the people inside than outside. And I cite the Staten Island example because somebody actually did make a movie about women who hung out together on the 815 Staten Island ferry. And sure enough, they were kind of like, well, who's this woman with the camera over there? I mean, what is she intruding on our, you know, this is our our thing, you know. We're hanging out in the ladies' room, putting on our makeup, we're talking. What are you doing here? So So anyway, I mean, this is a long-winded way of saying that it's, this is not a term that, that is sort of standardized the way, you know, the bell curve is a definition you can look up. I mean, it's a term that's being kicked around by people who are who know that we need to find a way to talk about this.
Yeah. So, it's fuzzy, but it's very useful.
Well, I think so, and I think that it like a lot of useful terms, it relates to kind of common sense terms we all use in everyday life. I mean, you know, people talk about their sports teams or their extended family or their ethnic group. You know, we do this. We know somewhere deep inside that that these things are related, you know, and that that the good stuff, the fun stuff, going to the game and, you know, painting yourself blue or whatever the team color is and having a good time, you know, it's not completely unrelated to people getting carried away at a mass ideological rally and you know, getting swept up in fervent. It's not unrelated. So, you know, people are grasping for ways to talk about this because it is kind of new to think in these terms instead of thinking in terms of particular kinds of tribal identity. You know, vast literatures on what's nationalism all about and what is race and is race real and so on. And it's relatively new to have people start thinking in terms of the psychology of this, about what's going on in each mind that makes all of it possible.
Yeah. As I mentioned in my introduction, you know, it has a very sinister side, and you've just hinted at that. But yet you say, you know, we need our humankinds. They're essential. Why?
Well, I think it's because it's how we learn to be human. You know, we don't learn how to be human in a sort of generic way. I mean, we might think we do. I mean, like when parents turn to their kid and say, you know, we say please and thank you, and you know, we go to church on Sunday, and we, you know, we're polite to our elders. You know, sure, that's a language of every single person on earth does this way, and you got to learn to be a good person. You know, a proper person. You want to, you know, don't you want to act like a grown up? Don't you want to be a man or be you know, a girl, or, you know, I mean, be right, you know, learn how it is to be a person. And all societies have to do this with kids, right? And the fact of the matter is that even though the message is this is how a person behaves, it's generally really a message about how we behave, you know, our kind of people. And I guess this is really apparent in a big city where you will see people going to their religious services on different days. And you'll see a mother saying, oh, well, you know, we don't eat that. You know, we keep kosher, you know, sitting next to somebody eating a ham sandwich, you know. And so you realize that people are learning different versions of this sense of this is what a proper person does, and this is how to behave, and this is, you know, when someone dies, you do this, and when someone is sad, this is the proper thing to do, and if an old person speaks to you, this is how to address them. I think it's very much like language, where, I mean, I grew up speaking English, someone else might have grown up speaking Chinese, but underneath those differences, there is a capacity to listen and hear language and put it together when you're very young. And I really don't think you can be a person, as we all understand it, without this sense of knowing what to do, that comes from a sense of what kind of person you are. You know, this is what we do. Be it go to services on Friday because we're Muslims, or go to services on Sunday, or not go to services at all because we're secular humanists, you know, decide to put the kids' toys together on Christmas Eve, even though you're really tired because you want to be a good parent, which is certainly an important kind of person that people compare themselves to. And I think if you don't have this, if you just think, well, you know, we're all the same, it's all kind of whatever. Well, I just don't know anyone who operates that way, and I don't know of any society that operates that way. I do know some people will think they are. They'll say, "Oh, I'm, you know, I believe in the universal brotherhood of man," but that just sets them apart from people who don't. You know, that's not that too is a kind of an affiliation. So anyway, that's why. I mean, I just think we have a hard time making sense of that's how we figure out how good our life was and how good we are at getting through our day, is by reference to this these kind of categories.
So it's part of what makes us human. And here's my next question. Do other animals draw anything like these kinds of boundaries? And are there, for example, you know, pack kinds in canines?
Oh, sure. And absolutely. I mean, you know, my book is filled with neuroscientists and anthropologists and psychologists. I mean, it's, you know, it's not all science, but I mean, it's sort of based on the assumptions of science, which is, you know, which is material causes and effects, and things are not supernatural, and you know, in their explanations. And so, you know, we evolved out of ancestors, and those ancestors share a lot of genes and behaviors with us. And so, you know, you should certainly expect to see similar things in animals, and you do, in the sense that many animals will you know, live in groups, and within those groups, it's not just your relatives who are important, but also the animals you grew up with, and the ones you like, and the ones you dislike. I mean, friends DeWall at Emory has done these great experiments where he'll prove that capuchin monkeys, if you know, you set up a food sharing system, you know, they'll just share food. They don't share food with any other monkey. They have friends. They have people. They have other animals they like better than others. So you get plenty of animals in group, you know, forming coalitions and fighting others. And a very common pattern is that people say, well, only human beings kill their own kind. Well, it's completely not true. But what is true is that many animals will not kill or be very, very reluctant to kill a member of their group. A member of the same troop. You know, somebody comes in from someplace else, boom, I mean, lions, gorillas, chimpanzees, I mean, he's dead or she's dead, depends which species. Some species is females that migrate, and some species is males. But here's the big difference. Animals decide this on, you know, basis of things that we can sort of understand and predict, and that, you know, like who likes whom, who's a friend, and kinship's very important, who's related to whom. But they don't decide on the basis of symbols, and they don't put the kind of symbolic concerns above the day-to-day practical face-to-face concerns. And human beings do. You know, I mean, my example of this is, you know, your dog is loyal to you because he's your friend. And your dog will protect her puppies, but your dog's not going to leave you if you put a peace sign on your lawn.
Mm.
You know, your dog's not going to. If you come home and say, you know, I've decided Islam is the religion for me, your dog's not going to go live somewhere else, because you know your dog is doing it on the basis of you, the individual, your particular acts, and his own experience. Whereas human beings will treat someone they've never met before as if they were, you know, more important than the people across the street. If the person they've never met before happens to be the same religion, even if they live 10,000 miles away, and the person across the street is from some group they don't like. So that's really extraordinary. And that's so this whole phenomenon is something that is partly explained by what we share with other animals, but it's partly not. And I think that's the weakness in some of the kind of evolutionary psychology explanations you sometimes hear about things like war and prejudice. Is I think there's this assumption that if we understand what chimps do, then we've figured out what people do. And I just don't think that's right, because people do this thing that other animals don't do.
Yeah. How is it that we imbue some of these boundaries with greater weight than others? What's at work there?
Yeah, that's... I think that you see that in a great many different places, I'm hesitating because I don't want to claim that this is something sort of science has discovered. I mean, this is what I personally think, having done the research on the book. I mean, I think that there are a very limited set of cues that tell you this person is okay, this person understands what I'm doing, this person is following the same rules that I am following when I, you know, we shake hands or make a deal or invite someone over for dinner or something. Because these cues are rather few, you see these sort of patterns throughout time, history, in many different places and many different times where if a, a society, a political arrangement has decided that a certain class of people is not good, is not right, is not to be treated well, they'll be spoken about and marked in some of the same ways in many different kinds of times and places. So, for example, a common thing I found was to explain that a particular, people who were enslaved, or might be people who were serfs, or people who were in some sort of prevented from being part of the rest of society in some way, the explanation would be, well, they helped our enemies generations ago. You know, in Korea it was the Mongol invasion, and it was a caste of people who were not allowed to be part of the rest of Korean society, and it was explained that they had helped the Mongols 200 years before. And in medieval Spain, there were people who were could not escape serfdom because supposedly their ancestors had helped the Muslims in their conquest. And so, you know, being aware that you see this, you know, and then when I hear President Bush get up and talk about how certain kinds of criticism of his policies are helping the enemy, are beyond the pale of what's acceptable because they give aid and comfort to people who are trying to kill us. To me, that just registers as yet another person discovering this old device of you know, painting your people you don't like as kind of just not right, not proper people, not part of us.
And this is really important, I think, because I think we do see manipulation of these categories for political ends.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think this whole swath of rhetoric I sort of think of them, they're kind of like drugs, you know. I mean, they have this really strong effect, and they please us. It pleases us to think that people who we don't agree with or we want to defeat are in some way not right, not proper. They don't really belong with us. But they're dangerous in the same way because they're not really about what we think they're about. I mean, another classic one that I think I counted a lot is you mark a bunch of people as somehow associated with death. You know, just like they're not healthy. They're not, you know, they carry diseases. You know, they're nasty. And you see this in the way that immigrants were treated in this country in wave after wave. That notion that they were bringing diseases and they would die, caused, you know, illness, recurs over and over. And you see it in sort of medieval regulations that said, okay, this is how we're going to treat lepers. And now we have the system for treating lepers this way. We'll treat Jews the same way. We'll give them the same. They have to wear badges, too, and they can't touch fruit in the market either, you know. You know, here again, you know, you think, oh, well, that's, you know, long ago and far away, but then you hear rhetoric about how, you know, AIDS is a gay disease and you know, gay men die in their 40s because it's just not a healthy lifestyle, and, you know, and I hear that and I think, you know, that's the same thing. It's not far away. We're still using these techniques on each other. And I'm not sure we could ever give them up totally, but I do think we sort of need to look at those kind of claims with complete skepticism. I mean, we just say, okay, we're no longer having a debate now. If you start talking about that bunch of people is ill or degenerate or, you know, somehow closer to death than my kind of person, we're not having a debate anymore. We're just pushing these buttons that are part of our psychology for deciding who's on my team and who's on the other team.
Mm-hmm. David Barraby is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He is the author of Us and Them, Understanding Your Tribal Mind. My name is Celeste Quinn, and listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with your questions, comments. Phone lines are open. Here are the numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. You know, you begin your book with that big question, that very profound question that Rodney King posed to us back in 1992, why can't we all get along? And you say, you know, we try to answer it, but we just fall short, way short. And part of this is we're comfortable falling back on what we think we know.
Yeah.
So where do we begin to think more thoughtfully about the question?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the best way to to think about it is to realize that there's a big gap between what we can be sure we know because that's the way our mind is built to tell us this is reality and, you know, just don't question it. There's a big gap between that and what is kind of really going on, or maybe be more accurate, what we can find out if we sort of apply the methods of science to the same question. So in the same way that, I mean, I talk about sunset, and, you know, or that was a great sunrise. I really don't think the sun is turning around the Earth. You know, I believe all the physics and the, you know, the result of the moonshots in the 60s and 70s, you know, that we're actually moving around the sun. So in the same way, I think we need to be a little more, a little more hesitant, I feel, about these things that we feel so sure about. For example, the idea that people will say things like, well, you know, they're a big Italian family. And that, you know, that's supposed to tell you, okay, you know, they're, you know, a certain way of talking to one another and you know, what Sundays are like at their house. And, you know, it's a very different feel from if you say, oh, well, it's an old WASP family. And, okay, I mean, that's fine. That's a sort of rough rule of thumb. You know, everybody knows what we're talking about. No harm done. But I think, you know, we just need to be a little more skeptical about why we're so easily pushed into thinking in terms of, okay, well, once I know your ethnicity, then I know how you're going to behave. I guess the other important thing, the thing that really struck me as kind of news when I was working on the book, is that we tend to think about these kinds of groupings, tribes, whatever you want to call them, as if they were this kind of big single entities, you know, like they were, as if they were giant people or something, you know. So you could say, well, you know, France is in a bad mood since it's riots or something, or, you know, or the, you know, what do Hispanic voters want? You know, as if Hispanic voters was a guy you could call up and say, so who are you going to vote for in the next election?
Mm-hmm.
I think the more we realize, or the more we keep reminding ourselves that these groupings are not, you know, literally facts. That they're things we are talking about and sort of creating as we talk about them. Then the less likely we will be to be led into kind of absurd notions about other human beings, because the fact of the matter is we're all members of lots of different groupings at the same time, and groupings come and go. I mean, red states and blue states didn't used to exist, and I think they probably will come a point where they don't again. And so we just have to be aware that these things that feel permanent, as if they explain everything to us, are not permanent and are changing all the time. And if we can keep that in mind, maybe we'll take it all a little less seriously. That'd probably be good.
Yeah. You mentioned personality types earlier.
Yeah.
Type A personality.
Yeah.
And in the book, it's interesting to note science is moving on. Science has moved on. But, you know, I'm still thinking about type A and type
yeah.
B. It persists, that idea persists
yeah.
among many of us.
Yeah.
But our ideas about these kinds of things do change. For example, our ideas about homosexuality are changing. Many people no longer view
yeah.
being gay as a pathology.
Right.
So things get shuffled around.
Right.
How is it that happens, and why such a lag
yeah.
between science and, you know, Celeste?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, because it's almost inevitable that any kind of shiny, attractive, prestigious scientific concept that sounds like the people who are using it must be smart and cool, that tends to linger in people's conversations way after scientists have abandoned it. You know, I mean, so for example, I mean, whatever people may think about Freudian psychoanalysis as a way of getting people to be better, certainly in terms of as a theory of the mind, it's really in retreat. And yet, I mean, 15, 16-year-old kids around me here in Brooklyn will say, oh, stop being so anal, you know, which is a term to describe a kind of a personality that, you know, I mean, this was sort of official kind of psychological doctrine, you know, maybe, I don't know, 50 years ago, 30 years ago. And now it's not, and yet it's still in our conversation. In the same way, people go, oh, man, he's a real type A type of personality, let me tell you. Even though people no longer do research on type A for its original purpose, about, you know, which is related to heart attacks. So, I would say the explanation is that it's that looping effect thing that that Ian Hacking talks about that I was referring to earlier, which is that I think people, once you get onto an idea and you use it to explain yourself to yourself and to other people, you kind of don't want to give it up. You know, once you've invested in it a bit, you know, once you've explained to enough people that the reason you're so stubborn is because you're a Taurus, each time that you do that, and each time an event in your life says, oh, wow, that really shows you how much of a Taurus I am, that's going to make you that much more resistant when someone comes along and says, you know, this Taurus thing, it's totally arbitrary. You know, if you were born in China, you'd have a totally different horoscope because, you know, you use these other signs of the zodiac. You don't want to hear that. The more you have invested in believing in a category or group or tribe, the less you want to hear that. So I think that's certainly an important part of this, you know, and the categories that we use when we say, okay, this is important to me and I'm loyal and this is how I know who my friends are, you know, whether that's real, unquote, in some scientific sense, kind of doesn't matter to us. That's not what we're using it for. You know, we're using it to, like, figure out, you know, what to do and how to be comfortable and who to go looking for when we get into town. The fact that some guys declared that it's not a real basis in biology is kind of beside the point, you know.
Hmm. Let's talk with a listener. We've got a caller waiting for us in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Yes, hello. I wonder, in doing your research, have you encountered the famous German philosopher Ernst Cassirer and his philosophy of symbolic forms?
Yeah.
He has some interesting comments to make about the difference between animal and human intelligence, which you were talking about a little while ago. And, of course, his position is that it's language that differentiates man from animal. Now, animals have language, of course, but it's a sign language, not a symbolic language. In other words, they're not able to deal with heavy abstractions and things of that kind, which I think is a pretty good rule of thumb. But it also indicates that one of the big differences between man and animal is that an animal can't be a fool. You look at squirrels jumping around out in the backyard.
Yeah.
No squirrel is a fool anywhere in the world. Now, they can be impaired, which means, of course, that they can't do their work or something of that sort. That's possible, in which case they probably die.
Yeah.
But one thing is, man is an animal who can reach great heights through art or science or something like that, but he also has the capacity to bamboozle himself with abstractions.
Yeah.
And therefore, a man can be a fool, whereas an animal can't.
Yeah. I think it was Voltaire who said, if you can persuade people to believe absurdities, then you can persuade them to commit atrocities.
Right.
I think that's a really important point about that speaks to some of the ideas that people had maybe 20, 30, 40 years ago about these questions, when it was sort of popular to think of the dark side of all this as a kind of animal side, as, you know, this terrible sort of aggression or hatred that was just boiling around, and thank God for civilization managing to sort of tamp it down and keep it under control. In fact, the kind of systematic cruelties and horrors of the last century were possible because people were capable of abstraction, were capable of thinking, all right, even though those people across the street look like me and they have kids that are the same age as my kids, I know, even though I feel that this is a terrible thing to throw them out of their home, I know abstractly that they're not Aryans, and so it's okay. In my book, I quote a bomber pilot, actually the guy who designed the bombing raids over Germany, saying that when you're bombing a city, of course you can imagine the house collapsing on the children. Of course you can imagine a little girl crying for her mother because you've bombed the place. But you put it out of your mind in order to do the work the nation demands of you. And I would say that that is not a animal aggression talking. That is not somebody losing control and deciding to have a tantrum. That's the opposite. That is someone thinking with their faculty for abstraction and idealization and putting aside their animal emotions, which are telling them, oh, my God, I'm hurting people. Haven't hurt me. And so I think that that's a very important point, yes, that it's because we have this capacity to not be literal and to not only bond with our kin and with the people right next door, but to imagine people across the globe being just like us and our allies in some way. I mean, that makes great things possible, but it also makes this kind of killing in the name of some abstract notion possible. So, yeah.
Well, I guess we hope that rational thinking and the educational system will take care of these problems, but probably it's mostly a futile thought.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I mean, I do think, you know, you can, I mean, I think if you study, if the system conveys real history, you know, not sort of the history of you know, ideals and of you know, perfect, our nation's perfect and, you know, our march of progress and Washington crossing the Delaware, but, you know, real history, which inspires a certain skepticism, you know, and a certain realization that peoples come and go and categories come and go and tribes come and go. I think, you know, maybe you can make some progress. And if you sort of talk about real the real psychology of people and how you can become, people can change and their ideas can change and their perceptions can change in important ways. I don't know. I don't know whether to be pessimistic or optimistic. I mean, you know, I think the record is filled with terrible cycles of violence among groups, but it's also filled with the abandonment of violence. Yugoslavia is, you know, a great example. I mean, people acted as if, you know, people talk about ancient hatred. You know, Yugoslavia fell apart in the 90s because of ancient hatred, you know, which was ignoring 40 years of non-hatred, you know, 40 years of high intermarriage rates and of people saying, I'm not a Serb or a Croat, I'm a Yugoslav. And, you know, I'm not, I think we generally in a situation, in most situations, people can go either way. And that's what's important here. You know, and I think it's important not to sort of say, well, you know, we're just heading, slouching towards Bethlehem, everything's going to get worse. I think things can always get worse, even in supposedly placid places. And I think they can get better, even in really bad places.
Hmm. I want to thank the listener for his call, his comments and questions this afternoon. Other listeners are invited to join us. You can join us with a telephone call, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Our guest this afternoon, David Barabee, author of Us and Them, Understanding Your Tribal Mind. The book is about how and why we separate ourselves into groups. And we're happy to take those telephone calls this afternoon. You know, you say in the book that science is helping us better understand this phenomenon, us and them. Would you give us some sense of the work of mind science today and
sure.
the questions that mind science is working on in terms of kind-mindedness?
Yeah. Well, there's I mean, I mentioned Larry Hirschfeld before, a psychological anthropologist. He is one of a number of people who have worked on the question of how we know what we know. What is it that makes, as the mind sort of assembles itself, you know, in early, very early childhood, and figures out, okay, this is how to work language, and this is how to understand living things, and this is how to understand what happens when you throw a ball or when a ball comes rolling to you. I mean, this great work being done on how this, ever since Piaget, right, on how this is done and how the mind puts itself together and what kind of principles it follows. So there's a whole, I mean, he's done experiments with kids all over the world that showed that, you know, there's certain kinds of predispositions, there's certain kinds of ways of understanding how people group together that seem easier for kids than others. So that, you know, he'll do an experiment where he'll ask the kid, okay, here's a, here, you know, he'll show pictures of adults and children, the cartoons, And you can, there'll be obvious sort of ways you could group them, like they'll, some of them will be wearing similar clothes, and some of them will be the same color, some of them will be the same height, and the color thing is easier for kids. You know, they seem to go for that. They'll say that the child is of one color belongs with the parents of the same color, even if the clothes are different or the other factors are different, which suggests that there are certain kind of cues that are, you know, much stronger, that the mind pays more attention to when it comes time to grouping people. And then, you know, even at the level of neuroscience, I mean, there's really interesting work done now on how the parts of the brain that have to do with fear and with strong emotion and with stress, how that relates to these kinds of social group questions. For example, there was an experiment done by a guy named Robert Kurzban at UCLA some years ago where he had people look at photographs and listen to a little story about the people in the photographs. And it was obviously had been involved in some kind of dispute, and there were sentences in the story like, oh, well, they were the ones who started the fight. And what he discovered is that people were much more likely to believe, this is Americans in California, right, they were much more likely, even if the fight was between cross-racial groupings, they were way more likely than is accurate to believe that the people involved in starting the fight and were black. So, okay, so he discovered this kind of predisposition that, you know, to kind of add something that wasn't actually in the information about who was supposedly the more aggressive person in these encounters. But then he did the experiment again, and he put people in basketball jerseys, and the different colors of, the jerseys were different colors. And what he discovered is that just showing people this new way of categorizing, just, you know, okay, you see that there's a racial difference, but you also see that some of these people are on one team and some of these people on the other, that really muted the tendency to remember things in racial terms. So you know, there, that's evidence that of the sort of flexibility that I was alluding to earlier. That you know, if you give people an alternate way of categorizing, even if, you know, we're used to thinking in race in this country for 500 years, you know, they'll pick up on it and use it. But that's not exactly neuroscience. I mean, I'll give you an example of neuroscience. There have been people who have placed volunteers in an MRI scanner, and they'll show them pictures of people, and they'll take note of the fact that the amygdala, which is a sort of small part of your brain that's kind of well inside, kind of in the middle, that responds to sort of alarming or exciting things. It kind of sparks if you're sexually aroused, and it sparks if you're really scared, and it sparks if you're startled. When I say sparks, I mean it sort of gets more active and starts sending signals out. This part of the brain tends to behave differently when people see someone of a different race than their own. Now, does this mean people are hardwired to prefer their own race or feel more at ease with their own race? I don't think so. I think what it means is that if you grow up in a society where there's a very clear message about you know, which race is kind of, you know, average American, which race, you know, is, you see people committing crimes or being talked about in the movies or as you know, dangerous. You know, these kind of subtle messages of who you're supposed to be afraid of, or who is you know, not part of mainstream American society. Well, I mean, it's not just a kind of airy fairy cultural message. I mean, it, like anything else that you experience, it has an effect on your brain. And so, you know, here's people in an MRI scanner, and you can see the effect. You know, they're this little meter that's supposed to tell them when they're scared, if you want to crudely describe the amygdala that way, is actually fitting the social pattern.
Yeah.
So this is kind of work that, I mean, these are all things that used to be completely separate. Like, there was brain stuff, and there was psychology, and then there was sort of the social affairs. And one of the main points of the book is it's coming together now, you know? It's like, it's no longer considered crazy to use an MRI scanner to talk about how people perceive race. And it's no longer considered crazy to think, well, let's see what toddlers think about race. Let's see why we believe in race in the first place by figuring out how people first come to that concept. So that's what's really cool now, is that all this work is coming together.
Yeah. We have to wrap up here.
I'm sorry. That's
okay. I can give you, I want to ask you one more question.
Sure.
In terms of summing up, I think it's a really nice way to sum up. It's how you sum up us and them. At the end of the book, you open your conclusion by suggesting, you know, to put it in grammatical terms, we imagine ourselves in a world of nouns, but the mind's environment is one of verbs. You want to just very briefly take a minute or a minute and a half and elaborate on that.
Sure. Thanks. Yeah. I think that's one of the ways, and one of the things I was saying earlier is we imagine that something like France or black people or, you know, the people of Brooklyn or Muslims are this kind of big sort of actual entity, you know, that can have desires and wishes and so on. Or we imagine that they're kind of like starlings or squirrels, like a species, you know, like in every single, you know, once you know that this fact about them, then you understand a great deal. When in fact, what we have we go through life sort of changing every second, every minute, our experience is altered by what's going on around us and what we want out of it. And so my sense, as I say in the book, I mean, it may well be when we have a better language to talk about all this, that we don't say, oh, I'm in an Italian neighborhood in Brooklyn. We might be more accurately say, at this moment, I'm having a kind of Italian experience. And in the next moment where I cross the street and I'm surrounded by teenagers, I might be having a more of a middle-age experience. And, I mean, I think that's probably going to be a more accurate way to talk about all these issues because that's how the mind works.
Yeah.
It's a constant state of change.
Very interesting. David, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me. I've enjoyed it.
My pleasure. David Barraby has been our guest in this portion of the afternoon magazine. He is the author of Us and Them, Understanding Your Tribal Mind. The book is published by Little Brown and Company. It's 1:53 Central Time. Settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Dave Dickey.
Thank you very much, Celeste, and good afternoon, everyone. It was a light volume day today at the Chicago Board of Trade, but nonetheless, the day ended with a lot of red on the screen as contracts broke through both support levels as well as moving averages today to settle to the red March wheat, as well as March corn and December corn all went under the 50-day moving average today. The wheat in the continuation of charts approached the 100-day moving average. And then we saw some support levels fall away too. We'll have to discuss the implications of all of that technical bearishness in just a few minutes with Paul Cooley of ADM Investment Services. He is in Oakland, Illinois. Let's go ahead and look at the settlements. March wheat in Kansas City had a high on the day of 374, a low of 371 settling, 372 and three quarters, down 2.5. July, a high of 374.5, a low of 372, settling 374.5, down 2. March wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade, a high of 327.5, a low of 321.5, settling 322.5, down 6.25. May, a high of 337.5, a low of 332.5, settling 333.5, down 5.25. July, a high of 346.5, a low of 341.5, settling 342.5, down 5.5. September, a high of 355.25, a low of 351, settling 352.5, down 5. December, a high of 367.75, a low of 364, settling 365.25, down 4. March corn, a high of 207, a low of 205, settling 205.75, down 3. May, a high of 216.75, a low of 214.5, settling 215.5, down 2.75. July, a high of 225.5, a low of 223.5, settling 224.25, down 3. September, a high of 233.5, a low of 232, settling 233, down 2.5. December, a high of 243.5, a low of 242, settling 243.25, down 2. March, a high of 250 and a half, a low of 249, settling 250 and a quarter down 2 1/4. March Oats, a high of 185 and 3/4, a low of 182 and 3/4, settling 185 down 3/4. May, a high of 182, a low of 180, settling 181 down 1. March soybeans, a high of 567.5, a low of 563.5, settling 565 3/4, down 5.5. May, a high of 576.5, a low of 572.5, settling 574 3/4, down 6. July, a high of 585.5, a low of 581.25, settling 584.5, down 5 1/4. August, a high of 588, a low of 585.5, settling 586, down 5 1/4. September, a high of 591, a low of 587.5, settling on its low, down 6.5 on the day. November, a high of 596.5, a low of 592, settling 594.5, down 6. January, a high of 601, a low of 598.5, settling $6.75, down 5 3/4. March soybean meal, a high of 178, a low of 175.60, settling 177.50, down 280. May, a high of 180, a low of 178, settling 179.70, down 290. March soybean oil, a high of 21.37, a low of 21, settling 21.16, down 6. May, a high of 21.71, a low of 21.36, settling 21.60, down 3 on the day. Settlement prices also in on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, where Celeste, the ink was just as red as over at the board.
Yeah, prices significantly lower today for livestock.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from First Midwest Bank, serving the banking needs of Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Mike Morris in McHenry at 815-344-7213. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
January feeder cattle, the high today 112.12.5, the low 111.55, the settlement 111.77.5, that down 50. March 112.40, the high 110.72.5, the low, the settlement 111.20, that down 125. April 112.95, the high 111.75, the low 112.35, the settlement, that down 72.5. February live cattle 96.75, the high 95.70, the low 96.07.5, the settlement, that down 47.5. April live cattle 95.05, the high 94.20, the low 94.50, the settlement, that down 45. February lean hogs 59.75, the high 58 even, the low, the settlement 58.15, that down 132.5. April 64.80, the high 62.80, the low 63 even, the settlement, that down 162.5. May 67.25, the high 65.75, the low, the settlement 66.27.5, that down 115. June lean hogs 70.80, the high 69 even, the low 69.30, the settlement, that was off 160. February pork bellies 83.